doing? This is Cliff. I hope most of you, if you can, are reviewing and hanging out at the on the Facebook page that we have Earth Agents material on. And I say that because there's really no other place to find the collection of material that not only I put up, but a lot of our senior members put up. There's a couple of really great galleries on Mount Albán, Oaxaca, Mexico, which is a real interest of mine. It's a ruin that was built up on the top of a cluster of mountains. And to this day, they explain away how the mountain was basically sheared flat on top, this series of pyramids in what, without really knowing what the thought was, appears to be, you know, if you look at it from the sky, it's like an airport. Flat out, it looks like an airport. And I haven't had a chance to go there yet, but and I don't know any major research has done there, but there's something really funny going on at Mount Albán. Here's a reason, and I spoke about this before. On certain of these minor pyramids, there are central locations that that kind of curve inward. They bevel in. And over a number of years, they found a series of underground canals that lead from the center of these areas to, looks like, exit outside the side of the mountain that these places are built on. And we're not talking one or two of these canals. They're very small. They're precisely cut. There's one under each of the smaller pyramids, and there's a couple under the major pyramids. And for years they thought, well, these are burial sites, but they're like very small. They're too small to crawl in. And to my mind, they're exhaust chambers. They're exhaust systems. They were built underneath these central areas to extract exhaust or fluids or something. And they even have I even have some photo documentation from someone who took some pictures there of strange residue and even charred walls, like something was burning and has some form of exhaust there. So check out Mount Albán. It was put up by one of our senior members just yesterday. And you can see this at Earth Ancients Facebook. Go to the group page. And he's got like 26 photos, but they're very, very good. Now, this is Ernest Pfeiffer, by the way. And he's one of our senior members of Earth Ancients Facebook. And he does fantastic work. His photographs are fantastic. The other thing I want to mention is I've been fascinated with elongated skulls for years, decades. And I put up, and let me just say that I've been a collector of artifacts, and a number of my artifacts are of these little figurines with elongated heads that come from, South America, Peru. I even have some that are Maya from Chiapas, but I posted a series of figurines from Ecuador, and these figurines are unique for one specific reason. When you look at them, the craniums on these figurines are either elongated or they're very wide, unusual craniums, unusual heads. And I know for a fact that most of these and we know because they're found in burial sites, the remains of the actual people that these figurines were taken of, the portraits from, the civilizations are gone. They've left. And we don't know if they left because they died out, natural selection, there was famish, lack of food, lack of water, or what's coming up more and more in books from Grant Hancock is that the Earth was shifted in such a way, took a hit from an asteroid, a tsunami hit this area, water or something, and wiped the people out. But we don't know where they are. But I posted this these images. It's called Lost Civilizations, Ecuador, Tumaco Civilization. And these are from the Tumaco area, which is Ecuador, northern Ecuador. And when you look at these figures, you'll see that all of them have strange, strange skulls. And I have a number of people comment on these skulls that, oh, perhaps they're just stylized. Perhaps these are just cute little dolls. Well, I added a further photograph taken from an Ecuadorian museum that's littered with these amazing skulls. And I have a photo of a very, very wide skull, which is featured in one of these figurines. I have one that's exact, looks like a cone head from the Saturday Night Live series with Dan Aykroyd, the cone heads. There's a cone head, and then there's a very long, wide skull that is both of these, the cone head and the wide, long skull or elongated skull, are too big to have been artificially wrapped. I've mentioned this in the past, that a lot of these ancient cultures that have died off had between 20 and 35% more brain matter than we did. And thus you're going to have a bigger cranium. So these guys are monstrously big in the kind of the Paracas Peru style. But anyhow, you can see these things. Elongated skulls are always a fascination of mine. I can't wait till somebody does some serious study, some serious analysis, takes a complete skeletal remain from one of these people with these elongated skulls and does some solid research and analysis. And we've already known that some of these guys have another rib. We know that they have some of these cultures that have died off have more brain matter. They have thicker jaws, heavier bones, and they're significantly taller. Some of them are 7 feet. So where they went, we don't know. But check it out. And every show I try to mention the Facebook page because there's some really cool photos. You hear a lot about the people on the show, but we put material on Facebook so you can kind of check it out. To do that if you can. Facebook Earth Ancients, go to group. I didn't put it on the international page because I don't know. I think it's there's more interesting stuff on the group page. Next week I'm doing a special program. I'm going to be at the going on, I'm going to be at the New Living Expo. And Mike Barra is going to be there. He's got a new book out on Mars question. Scott Walters will be out there. He's got a new book out on the Templars, the Knights Templar. And Clifford Mahody will be out there speaking on Native traditions of Lemuria and the connection with star people. I'm going to do quick interviews with each one of them as I'm there. I'm a consulting producer of that event, and each of them have graciously allowed me to do 20 minute, maybe longer interview. So next week's program is going to be interesting. Haven't come up with a title yet, but you will know about it. So stay tuned for that. So today I'm talking about ancient traditions, ancient earth traditions with hunter-gatherers. And the reason I'm presenting this interview today is that, our society, especially in the industrial or prosperous societies, have tremendous amounts of illness. I did a bit of research and found out that we're losing about 500,000 people a year to cancer, 1.2 million people a year to heart disease, cardiovascular disease. And the levels of catastrophic and chronic illnesses in the United States alone and some of the other civilized, highly industrial countries is really, really high. And that doesn't even account for the levels of mental illness, the deep depression, and the suicide rate among our colleagues here in the United States. And even with a multi-billion-dollar healthcare system, we're one of the sickest nations in the world. I've been thinking about this, and this has led me to our guest today. You know, our ancient ancestors really had a very close connection to the earth. And we hear about that through the shaman programs we've had. We've talked to people about connecting to the earth, why it's important to get out, to get exercise in nature. But what we're left with today is so much disharmony that we're sick. We're constantly sick. And this interview today that I am going to play here in a second is with a person who has studied, not only studied, but lived with Native Americans and others who really have an understanding of why we have so much dis-ease, but more to the point, why it's important to get out, to connect with nature, to have some form of harmony in your life so that you can avoid these problems, avoid these physical illnesses, avoid these mental collapses. I mean, we're always working. We constantly work. We're looking to the future. How am I going to save money? How am I going to survive? And there's just not a way to be healthy. So here's the interview. My guest today is Tamarack Song, and I'll come back at the end and talk about next week's program. My guest today has spent his life studying the world's Aboriginal people, apprenticing to elders, and learning traditional hunter-gatherer survival skills. He's spent years alone in the woods, as well as living with a pack of wolves, which I will have to ask him about. In 1987, he founded the Teaching Drum Outdoor School in the wilderness of northern Wisconsin, and he's actually the author of several books, including Entering the Mind of the Tracker. Tamarack Song, welcome to the program.
Oh, Cliff, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here. We're going to be talking about some of my favorite topics, I understand, so I'm looking forward to it.
You know, I'm fascinated by your work. This book, Becoming Nature, Learning the Language of Wild Animals and Plants, is something I think some people might go, well, how does that relate to me? But the bottom line, what you're trying to say here in your work is, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, is that we need to connect with nature on a more regular basis, if not become nature in a way where we're quieting the mind, we're going out and interacting with nature more. I mean, is that kind of the premise of the book, that we're somewhat separated from nature?
Yes, it's the premise, but actually it's a hook, because what I wanted to name the book, title the book, was Re-Becoming Nature, because we already are nature. You know, we're Mother Nature's child, and there's no way we can shake the nature out of us. So my premise here is to entice people to open the book so that they can recognize that they already are nature and that there's really nothing to learn, that what we need to do is to peel off the layers of conditioning that we have accumulated in order to essentially let the bud blossom. We are already there. We already have these intuitive abilities, our ancestral memories, these capacities. We're born wild, and we go through a domestication process, actually, as we learn to become acculturated and civilized.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. You know, most of us, at least for me, I have an inclination to get out and walk in nature occasionally, and I love to hike. For me, it's a form of regeneration, kind of relieving the tensions and the stresses of the day. Is that enough of a reconnection with nature, do you think? Or does there need to be more thought around connecting?
Well, and you know, that's a great question. And I think I'll answer it by giving the example of the illustrator of this book, Becoming Nature, Christine Scheiner. She lives in Manhattan. And get this, she writes a nature column based on her sixth floor apartment in Manhattan. She's up early. Yeah, believe it or not, she writes
Manhattan,
a nature column.
Yeah, really.
It fascinated me. I haven't spent a lot of time in big cities, but she just opened my eyes to what's there. She gets up early in the morning and she sees the raccoons and the opossums going down the alleys and the streets, and they're going in before daylight. And she talks about the birds in the city. She sees cardinals and robins. And, of course, you expect to see pigeons and starlings and sparrows in the city, but she says there's much more than that. There are chimney swifts and swallows up on the roofs of the tall buildings. And she talks about the bees and the butterflies, and that amazed me. She said the people who have planters out and flower pots, you know, there are butterflies and bees there, and there are ants. And she's talking about all of this life that she observes. And wherever there's a little wet spot, there's frogs and tadpoles right in the city there. It was just fascinating to me. So nature's everywhere. I mean, if she can connect in downtown Manhattan, I think any of us can connect anywhere with nature. So
it's fabulous.
The important thing that catches most of us up, which is why we don't recognize the nature we're immersed in all the time, is that usually when we go outside, we go out to get from point A to point B, and that's it, you know, and whatever is going on in between is just superfluous, you know. We just have to get to work or go to see our friends or go to the store or whatever we're doing, going to a movie or whatever, and we're not immersed in the now. We're not involved in the process of our life. Everything is future projecting. What am I going to do next? What do I want to accomplish? What do I want to achieve here? Where am I supposed to be? And I think that's where we miss it. And I've learned some things from my Zen practice, which I don't call it a Zen practice because it's just the native way, just to be present, to be fully connected with the means and ends of my own existence. And when I do that, the world around me just comes alive. I become more sensitized and I start noticing things.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at your website and you connected with an elder that I knew before he passed away, Thomas Benyakia, a Hopi elder. And it looks like you connected with a number of elders in the earlier parts of your life. When I talk to elders, they tell me that our society has a lot of problems. They don't get too focused on specifics, but to my mind, they are uncomfortable with how we live. And I think they have something to say about that because we have more illnesses, physical, and a tremendous amount of mental illnesses that seem to reveal that we're not taking care of ourselves and reviving ourselves and refreshing ourselves with nature. What do you say about that? Do you think that's a fair assessment by these elders?
Oh, I think it is. I'm a student of native languages. I've studied the Ojibwe language. They're the native people living closest to me on the reservations. And what I learned right away is that there are two elements of their language that we don't have. One is that theirs is a language of verbs. Even what we consider to be nouns, place names, names of people, are actually verbs. For example, I met a woman named Bear. I thought her name was Bear. Well, it's not Bear. It's Heart of Bear. It's the feeling, the sense of being a bear. It's not, oh, this woman is called Bear at all. And on, the name for owl, for example, we have a name for it, a bird, owl. And what does owl mean? We have no idea. We have to memorize the association in order to label owl. Well, their name is Goo Coo Coo, and that's the sound the owl makes. And it's just phenomenal. The name for deer is Wawashkeshi, and the deer running through the brush here in the tall grasses, that's the sound they make, Wawashkeshi. And you can just feel, you can sense it nonverbally. You know, the language is a song. The language is full of metaphor and symbols. And our language is so noun-oriented and so rational linear. So right there, it's just in communicating, there's this sense of relationship, this sense of immersion, this sense of connection. And there's just a different feel to that way of life. And here's where the native elders are just so perplexed with us. You know, what are you folks doing? You know, you've got everything categorized and labeled, and this isn't life. This is things, you know. It's what goes on between these things that creates dynamic and relationship and spontaneity, and here's where the energy is, you know, the laughter and the tears and the richness and lushness of life. And they just, I don't know, they just roll their eyes sometimes, and some of them just become desperate alcoholics. They don't know what to do. Can't handle it.
It's strange. So would you say that from their perspective, they look at us and kind of go, no wonder you have illness, no wonder you have insanity, so much depression in America. You know, is it that we don't connect with the great Mother Earth?
Yeah, there's a constant cleansing going on. I study trauma because I work with it a lot. You know, I take people out in the wilderness, and they oftentimes end up being traumatized. About 30% of the people end up in high stress conditions and become, well, that's another story talking about trauma, but actually they don't become traumatized. What happens is that childhood traumas come up, they surface, because they're denied and suppressed in our regular lives. You know, we have our coping mechanisms, etc. So, you know, we learn how to adjust to the imbalances within us. And anyway, out in the wilderness, there are no coping mechanisms. You know, we can't turn on the music. There aren't movies to watch. We can't, you know, douse ourselves with caffeine or alcohol or whatever. We have to be real with ourselves. There's no way around it. So these trauma memories start surfacing. And the beauty in nature is that with native people, there's a constant cleansing going on. I'll give you an example. When native people, when a group comes back from the hunt, the guardians might come back and there might have been a skirmish with some other people, and there's stress, there's accumulated stress, and they need to release it. So right away, the first thing that's done is that a fire is made, a ritual fire, and everybody gathers around the fire, and the story of the hunt is told, and or the story of the chase or whatever occurred. And this gives them opportunity to go through the experience again, to relive it, and now they have the opportunity to release the stress. There's the fire, which is hypnotizing. There's the rhythm of the drum, which helps to calm with the heartbeat. And there's chant. It's illegible chant. It's nonverbal chant, which works very similarly to a mantra. You know, it's just hypnotizing. It's mesmerizing. And there are these ritual ways, shamanic ways, you might say, that there's this stress release, and then there's a feast after where the clan welcomes them back, and they have this support and this trust and this caring, and then all is well, all is released, and life is good again.
And so it sounds like a natural kind of a, as you call it, a stress release when they go through these traumas, but it is detoxifying is what you're saying, both mental and physical. Is that what you're saying, basically?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it happens naturally in nature anyway. I remember once I came home from an event. It was a stressful event because it was an ACOA meeting, and there were some people there who were really traumatized, and it brought up childhood memories for me. And I came home, and I was filled with all this tension. And, you know, I was reliving some of my childhood dramas. I came from a pretty dysfunctional family. And I went out into the backyard, and I built a fire, a ritual fire. And I sat there for 3 or 4 hours, and I just stared into the flames. And there's something, there's a magic to fire. In fact, I read an anthropological study about how fire helped to make us human, because when we evolved as humans, as proto-humans, we were eating raw foods and we could only get so much energy out of it. And we had small brains and big guts like the rest of the great apes do. And when we developed our relationship with fire, we could start cooking food and we could process some of these hard foods and get more energy and more nutrition out of them. And that's when we started evolving bigger brains and smaller guts, because fire was cooking our food which it partially digests it, actually. So we did not need big guts. More energy could be devoted to our mental processes, and that in essence is what made us human. So we have this intrinsic relation with fire. And the real proof, though, that I got was when I look at the young of other animals, they're all afraid of fire. But what do we do when we're young? What did you do when you first were introduced to fire? You were fascinated by it, right?
Yeah.
I remember, my brothers and I would go out in the backyard and we'd sneak the matches out and we'd make some fires, you know, and we're just fascinated with fire. So there's something about this relationship with fire, and that's why it has such healing potential. Even a lit candle, just staring into a candle. You go to church, traditional churches have candles, they're votive candles, etc. That's the reason. There's the spirit of fire that touches something deep in our souls and calms us.
Wonderful. What is the animal mind that you talk about? I'm very curious about that. Why is it important to kind of take on the animal mind when we're out in nature?
The animal mind is our, neuroscientists would call it our limbic process. It's our deeper mind that lies just below our frontal lobes. It's the mind that we have in common with all mammals. It's the processing point for our feelings, our senses, our intuitive abilities. Our long-term memory is imprinted there. It's all in our limbic process. And when we function from there, we function non-verbally. You know, we function by impression and feeling and intuitive impulse. And, you know, what's interesting to me is that we think we're rational creatures. We think we function from our intellects. But actually, our intellects only process about 1 to 5% of what we process all the time. We think we are rational creatures because this is our conscious mind. This is where our ego is embedded. So we think our rational mind is running us, but it's not. Our limbic process is doing 95 to 99% of the work. It just doesn't get the credit. So when we're out in nature, it's really important to just quiet down the rational mind. All of our needs and desires and fears and our dreams, all of that is all connected with our rational processes. And just set it aside. We don't have to get rid of it, but just set it aside and just be present and listen. Listening is the doorway.
And that in turn makes us, or connects us with nature, but also makes us one of the animals, is basically what you're saying. And that way there's the beginnings of a open communication, or you can't really communicate. I mean, it's kind of an intuition in a way, communication with the animals. Isn't that what you're basically saying? Because I think that's fascinating. You have much of your book, Becoming Nature, has techniques for quieting down and listening and communicating, which is fascinating. Can you talk to us a little bit about becoming an animal?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. It's something that Native people do when tracking, for example. The way us civilized people track is that we go out and we read the sign and follow the footprints and find out where the animal is, where the animal's going, what the animal is doing. And that's fine. It's like reading a book. You know, you open up and you look at the pages and illustrations and whatever, and you read it. And you can read the woods in the same way. And I'm not saying Native people don't do that. However, their primary way that they track is to become the animal, to go inside the animal and feel what the animal feels, to know the animal's needs and wants and desires and fears and passions. And that way, this Native hunter, this Native tracker, knows what the animal is doing, where the animal is going, and doesn't have to follow the footprints, but can just go and walk there and just wait for the animal to come. And there's this communion, this relationship that breaks down the barriers between I and other. It's not, oh, I'm a human and that's nature out there. But first of all, I am nature, and I am not just human nature. I am nature. Like an organism, in an organism, you might say, if I were to pull out my liver and hold it before me, my liver would be nothing because my liver cannot function outside the organism. My liver is just a piece of meat. That's it. Has no purpose. It cannot survive. And the liver, even if it could, it cannot survive for itself because the liver is there to serve the other organs to create the organism. So we're the same way in nature. We are an organ within this greater organism. There is nothing without me functioning synchronously within this greater relationship. So that's what becoming nature is. It's literally becoming an organ within this greater organism.
And I love that analogy. That's a great analogy.
Yeah. It works. I use it a lot, actually, because people just get it.
What can those of us who live in the big city do to get the most out of our time when we're in a park or we're at the beach? I live on the coast here in the San Francisco Bay Area. A lot of people live in the Midwest and other parts. But what would you say if somebody has an hour or wants to get away, how can they get the most out of their time with nature?
To listen and to move. And the reasons for that are that we've learned to be passive receptors. When we go to school, the first thing we do is we learn that we have to sit in the desk and do certain things at certain times, and the teacher is up there, and I'm down here. I'm dumb, and the teacher's smart. That's why I'm here. So the teacher's going to fill me up with what I need to know or direct me to where he or she thinks I need to go in order to learn something. And it doesn't recognize that the system doesn't recognize that I'm already a complete being. Children are not incomplete adults. And even when we carry this into our adulthood, though, there's this sense of incompleteness. So we're always absorbing something. In our cars, we turn on the radio or slip in a CD. We have media, you know, we're watching a video or we're on, you know, doing some research online or we're at a seminar or whatever. We're constantly being fed. We're being fed, and we don't become a part of the feeding. So let's say I have an hour on the beach, as you gave with your example. Well, being conditioned to be a passive receptor, I might like to just get away from the hustle bustle and just go and sit and be entertained. Maybe there's a sunset. I'm watching the waves rolling in. And I'm watching the seagulls fly, and maybe there's some seals out there on the rocks or whatever. So here again, I'm being entertained. It's just, you know, instead of watching a nature video, I'm actually watching nature, but I'm still watching. I'm not immersed. I'm not an organ within the organism. I'm just taking it in. I'm just a sponge. And that's nice. It feels good when I'm there. However, as soon as I leave, there's a sense of emptiness again. And that's because I did not listen. And I don't mean listening just in terms of being a passive receptor again, but I mean listening in terms of total communication, of of resensitizing myself, feeling, walking. Rather than sitting there, I would spend the whole hour moving so that I'm a shadow, so that I'm a movement within the greater movement. Getting back to the organ metaphor again, the liver can't just sit there and just wait for everything else to happen around it, right? Because it ain't going to happen. That liver is a vital component of the organism, and so are we. And we find out what happens when we're not vital components of the organism. We are destroying our mother planet because we are not vital organs anymore. We've extracted ourselves. We've no longer taken personal responsibility. And it's the same thing that would happen if that liver in my body no longer took personal responsibility for its place in the organism. There is no difference. So the same thing. When I go out on the beach, I'm going to be immersed. I see a shell. I'm curious about that shell. I want to touch the seaweed. I want to feel the sand. I want to connect. I want relationship. I just don't want to sit there and be entertained.
Fascinating. You must have studied ancient culture, and I think you mentioned that before we started the program that you had studied cultures 10,000 years ago. Do you have a sense of how they connected with the earth? Do you have a sense of how they lived and how they became one with nature?
Well, I do. It's at least as far as I can. You know, my ancestors are so distant, I don't have that connection anymore. I never had it. However, I have a connection with my life with wolves, and I have a connection with other ancestral people, other Native and Indigenous people in Australia, Africa, and of course in North America here. And there's one thing that I picked up, and that is that's very important to me, because we oftentimes think of ourselves, oh, we're white people and we're civilized people, and those were colored people, those were Indigenous people, and you know, there's the big question of cultural appropriation. We're so different from them, and we ought to just be happy with our civilization and do the best we can with it, and not go there, not go where Native people go, because it's not us. And the strange thing is that when I've studied Native cultures and immersed myself in some of these cultures, and I cannot distinguish any real difference between these cultures. You know, when I account for the differences in the cultural adaptations to climate and the differences in language and customs and rituals, those are all surface differences. Underneath that, all Indigenous cultures are part of one culture, one earth culture, one human earth culture. And when I came to realize that, a light went on, and I recognized that there is this way of being that is intrinsic to being human. And it's not Native American, it's not Australian Aboriginal, it's not ancient Celtic. Those are labels that we civilized people have attached to them, because all of them just call themselves the people. The Ojibwe people in this area, for example, their term for themselves is Anishinaabe, which means the people or the spontaneous people. That's it. Dene, the term for the Navajo people, is their term. It just means the people. That's it. They're just the people, the human people. And the beauty here is that when they talk about bears and the deer and the fish, they are the fish people and the bear people and the deer people. They're all people, just like we are, just like we're human people. So there's this kinship, this brotherhood and this sisterhood, this interrelatedness. The funny thing is that back in the 60s and 70s, I got involved in the Back to the Land movement, and a lot of intentional communities were springing up. And we went out to start a community, whereas Native people are immersed in this community already with all their kin, they will start a camp. But that's it. They will camp within the community. The community already exists. Mm. So there's a big difference there. There's a big difference in perspective.
Fascinating. You know, you describe a study by a physicist, Gabor Horvath, who, together with some other colleagues in Hungary, analyzed thousands of pieces of prehistoric and modern art to see who most accurately portrayed an animal's gait, which is a fascinating study. And what was interesting about this is that you looked at people like Da Vinci and some of the modern artists, you know, the Renaissance and some even present artists. Can you tell us what you discovered regarding the gait aspect of living in and becoming a focused naturalist or a nature person?
Yeah, this was a fascinating study because our gait as bipeds is pretty simple, you know, one foot in front of the other. But when you have four legs, gait becomes pretty complex. There are many ways in which the legs can move. There's a big difference between a trot, a gallop, a full run, a bound. The legs all move in different ways, a side straddle. And native people have an intrinsic understanding of this because the animals are their brothers and sisters again. They live with them. They know. And the depictions in our artwork are more often than not incorrect. The gaits are wrong. An artist will illustrate a horse, for example, a horse walking or galloping, and the legs are out of sync. Horses can't move that way. They don't really move that way. And it just shows how much we can love nature and love horses or dogs, but we really don't know the animals. We have an emotional connection with them. We know a lot about them, and we might hunt with them or ride them or whatever, but we really don't know them. We don't know how they move, and that is just a symbol of so much that we don't know about them, because we oftentimes anthropomorphize. You know, we think of them as extensions of us. Our dogs are our pets. We own our dogs. You know, we buy and sell horses or birds or whatever. And with native people, it's different. These are their kin, so they're with these animals. They observe them in a different way, in the same way that I was talking about listening before. It's not just passive listening, but their listening is integrated. And the same with their total relationship with the animals. It is integrated. And the other part of it is that native people move in many different ways, so they know these different gaits also, because when I go out running, for example, I'm out in the woods. I don't run on a trail. I get off the trail right away. And my quote-unquote running is partly crawling and jumping and going around things, between things. And I get a full-body workout with my quote-unquote runs. So I'm moving on all fours sometimes, and I know these different rhythms just because of the way I have to adapt and adjust to getting around and through things. And the same with native people, which is why they just know intrinsically what these different gaits are.
Mm-hmm. Was it, and I didn't see the details of the article, but or the analysis, but did they find that the cave paintings most reproduce the gaits accurately, or was it some of the figurines that were made? Where was the connection with the hunter-gatherers that was so accurately depicted?
You got it. That's exactly it. The cave paintings from 30,000 years ago or so, when cave paintings French caves and Italian caves and Spanish caves in particular, and also in Australia and in Western North America, the petroglyphs were showing depictions of animals, and the gaits were most often right, whereas Da Vinci got it wrong. You know, Da Vinci was very wise and did a lot of things very well, but he got the gates of his animals wrong. And interestingly, in our contemporary society here, the people who depict animals who get it right most of the time are taxidermists. They, for some reason, they study the animals, and the good taxidermists want to get their mounts really correct. So they usually get the gates right too. Not as often as the native people who made the cave paintings get them right, but they got them right a lot more consistently than artists do, contemporary artists.
That's interesting. Would you say if you went to like a museum where they have stuffed animals, that those would be closely aligned with the true gait of animals, or hard to say, I guess. Huh? It depends on where the education came from.
Yeah, right. It's all about percentages. I think taxidermists get them right about 65% of the time, 75% of the time. Not all the time, but above average for sure.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I'm an artist, and I have a lot of friends that are artists, and I was just fascinated to hear that, to know that these are not actual well-reproduced illustrations or paintings. The gates are wrong.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
It's a big deal. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. You describe communicating with animals as nature speak, or you say first language. You know, there's something unique about that. It's an intuitive aspect of our consciousness at play. Can you explain that?
Yeah, we communicate largely verbally, and you know, there's some body language, of course. If I can actually see the person, you and I can't see each other right now, so we're communicating verbally. So you can't see my facial expressions. You can't see how I'm holding my body. This is a big element of communication that we are not able to partake in. And yet, there's language is a lot more than that. Even if we consider body language, et cetera, facial expressions, if I am communicating with a, let's say I'm looking outside my window right now, I see a squirrel, and in fact, he just moved. He's just walking on a log in my backyard here. I have a, you might say, a nature center right outside my window here. I've got the National Forest right outside.
Wow.
And he's sitting there, and I see him flicking his tail. Now, what's he flicking his tail for? He's communicating. He's not just communicating to me. He is communicating the organ within the organism element again. I can look at the squirrel, and I can see that tail flick, and I can say, oh, that squirrel is nervous. And if I look up to the left, I don't see her right now, but sometimes there's an owl sleeping up there, and it's cloudy today, so that owl is usually active at night, but the squirrel might be very nervous because the squirrel knows the owl's up there. And I can look to see if the owl's up there. Oh, the owl's not up there. The squirrel must be nervous for some other reason. And I know that squirrels typically flick their tails anyway as a diversionary tactic, because if squirrel's going to get attacked, the flick tail is the lure, you might say, so the squirrel's vitals aren't hurt. The attacking animal might grab the tail first, so the squirrel can get away, maybe with a shorter tail, but the squirrel's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
However, when the squirrel stops and freezes, but there's still that little tail flick, I know that he's attuned to something. So I look around and I see what else is going on, and it just keeps going like this. And this is the total communication. It's not just the squirrel and I communicating. It's all of these voices that I'm taking in at the same time. And I do that just intuitively, in the same way that you could walk into your living room and you just pick up impressions right away. You can tell if someone was there, if something's out of place, or you know, if your kids left some cookies there, you know that, oh boy, they were here after school and they didn't pick up after themselves. And there are all these impressions that you just you just process instantaneously and you know what's going on right away. Well, it's the same with me in the woods, and it's the same with you in the woods once you realize that, oh, this is just like my living room. There's no difference. And once we become accustomed to it, this is what nature speak is all about, because it is nature speaking. It's not just one animal, and I'm not just out there to connect and communicate with that one animal, because what that one animal has to say is being told by a much greater voice than just that animal's.
When we're walking out in nature, is this feeding us on some level that we don't understand, this ability to connect with nature? Are we fed on some level that you've come to understand?
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. We already talked about how nature is a natural stress release, how we just relax in nature. Well, the research is showing some other things. You know how you just feel good when you're outside? You feel good when you take a walk in the park or out in the woods. Well, one reason is because the light is pleasing to our eyes, and when it's pleasing to the eyes, it's pleasing to the mind. It helps to relax the mind, and that is light that is filtered through green leaves for some reason. If it's reflected off of green leaves or filtered through green leaves or needles, it is soothing. It has a calming effect. It's nurturing. I forget the research. I think it was some Danish research that gave that, you know, wired people up in different environments, with different colored lights, natural environments. And it was the green light that did it. And,
So that's a real big benefit to be out there on an energetic level.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Yes. Without doing anything else, just being, you know, just being in nature, it does it.
Fascinating. You talk a lot about technology, and you actually give, you know, wireless as the example. And it has an effect of distancing us from connecting with nature. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, for me, it's obvious. If you're out, and I have a problem doing this, I'll carry my cell phone with me, which is a smartphone, because I have a computer. It's like a mini computer. I go on a hike and I want to take a picture, and then all of a sudden I want to look at my email.
Yeah, of course.
So it's a
distraction,
which is really bad. I was thinking about this yesterday when I was hiking. But that's the distraction. But is there more to that? I mean, is that wireless technology just not a good thing for us?
You know, the odd thing, Cliff, is that it is not good for us even if we don't use it. Because even if I turn it off and I stick it in my pocket or my backpack, I know it's there. So I have this umbilical cord to it, and I have this subconscious connection, even though I'm not using it consciously, and it limits what I can experience in nature. You know, people talk a lot about media and how media distracts us and substitutes for real life. We have a virtual world now. Well, it's not just our active involvement in media. It's just the fact that it's there. And if I can get anything across to people, it's that, you know, I'm not knocking media, because I use media a lot. I'm a writer and I sit in front of a screen a lot. However, when I'm out in the woods, when I'm away from my screen, I do not carry a screen with me, because of what it does to my psyche. Even if I don't use it, it is limiting me. This is very important. This is critically important. The same with the wristwatch. Even if I don't look at my watch, I know it's there. I know subconsciously that it's there, and I can glance at it at any time, so I'm still dependent upon linear time.
So that's a serious negative, is what you're implying there. By carrying these technologies with us, we cannot become immersed and one with nature. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, it makes sense to me, because it is a distraction.
Yeah.
But But, you know, it's like, hey, I got to get that picture. I just got to get that picture to send my girlfriend. Uh-huh. Or I got, this is a great picture of a bird and so on and so forth. But, yeah, I mean, when you need that cleanse, as I'm going to call it, the detox is what I basically go to do when I take my hour and walk and hike. It's my time to turn it all off. And so taking it with me, you're reminding me basically that I need to leave it in the car as much as possible.
Yeah. You know, everything has its time. I would never knock you taking pictures of a favorite place for your girlfriend. It's a beautiful way to share it. Just don't do it all the time. Have some time for yourself to commune as well, where you leave that behind.
That's great. You discuss entering the silence and listening, and we've talked a little bit about it. The importance of that is the connection. Can you describe an exercise for what you describe as deep listening? Do you have an exercise we can get a sense of?
Let's see. Yeah, a few exercises come to mind. What's one that I could do pretty easily? Okay. There's one exercise for listening and seeing that works really well, and there are some easy steps. The first step I already mentioned, which is to move to find motion. And when we are moving, we're no longer passive receptors. You know, imagine if you were in the classroom as a kid and you got up and started moving. Well, the whole dynamic of the classroom would change, right? It's no longer all the kids sitting down and listening to the teacher up there. All of a sudden, there's movement and interaction. Well, the same thing in the woods. As soon as we start moving, things start appearing to us. And the reason is that there might be, there's a deer in the brush up ahead, but he's camouflaged so well in that I can't see him. However, if I take a couple steps off to one side or the other, I'm going to get a different angle, a different perspective on it, and all of a sudden that deer appears out of the brush, and I can see the deer. So it's moving to find motion and to find different shapes, different contours. And secondly is to watch for what I call watching for wallflowers. Wallflowers, the term is used for people who are just kind of quiet and shy and hang out on the periphery of a party. And they're really not noticed because you're engaged there. You know, you're engaged with the people in the middle of the room who are talking and animated about something. And the person sitting over there in the chair, you don't notice unless you look. So I back up and I look with peripheral vision instead of focusing on something. Oh, there's something. There's a really beautiful flower. Or, ooh, what is that mushroom? But just back up and gain perspective. And all of a sudden, that helps to bring things out of the background as well. It works amazingly. So I'm constantly alternating between focusing on something, gaining perspective, focusing, gaining perspective. And that's naturally what we would do if we're out in nature on a regular basis. And in fact, that's what we've discovered as far as having healthy eyes and healthy minds with screens, staring at screens. Once every hour, you're supposed to take a 5-minute break. This is the recommendation now to get up and stretch and focus your eyes on something distant. Take those breaks. Because this is just, it's the way we're designed. It's what would naturally occur if we were out in nature. So here's the same thing. And this is what native people do, what the hunters do and the gatherers do. And they start noticing these things that we wouldn't typically see. And another thing that I recommend to people is to leave your expectations at home. No, oftentimes we go out for a purpose. Oh, I want to see a beautiful sunset, or I want to go and see this cove on the beach that I remember that was, you know, about a half mile down or whatever. And what we end up doing is future projecting, and again, we miss everything in between. It's the same thing we do in the city and going from point A to point B and pretty much missing everything in between. So leave expectations at home and just go and be and allow to happen what happens, because typically what is going to happen, you're going to notice a whole lot more than what you went out to originally observe or experience. There's so much more there. That's there too, of course, but there's so much more as well. So if we leave our expectations at home, that starts appearing. Something else I recommend is to not take your dog with you. And this is tough for a lot of people because, you know, the dogs love to run, and but what do? They chase all the animals away, and if they don't chase them away, they quiet them down right away. Because here's a predator, and a very active predator, who is not moving within the greater movement. Dogs are very energetic and disjointed when they're outside, and I can understand it. If I was cooped up all the time, I would be too.
Yeah.
But, and again, it's nothing against dogs. It's not their fault, and there's a place to run with dogs. But if you're going out to commune and listen to nature, maybe not with your dog. You know, go to the park with your dog, or go out at another time when you just want some time with your dog. So that's a really big help for people. And one other item is to walk the edge. This is critical because oftentimes when we go out into a field or there's a beautiful hill up ahead, we want to walk up to the top of the hill or out into the middle of the field. Well, we do that, and we stick out like a sore thumb, right? Everybody knows and sees us, right. All the animals. All the other animals are in the edge, where the woods meets the field, or the rocks, the boulders meet the water, or whatever. Wherever there's that edge where they can blend into the shadows and just move along, and that's when you really start seeing things. You know, when you're inside a house at night and you're looking out, you can't see outside. But if you're outside and you're looking into the light, you're looking into somebody's living room, for example, they don't have the curtains drawn, you can see very easily inside because you're in the shadows looking in into the light. So that's what we do, walk the edge. Just walk right into the edge of the woods and you can look out and you can see all kinds of things you wouldn't see otherwise. So those are a few tips, and I have many more in the book. They're just simple tips that if you know them, you say, oh, duh, of course, this makes sense, but we just don't realize it. And it opens up a whole new world.
Those are great exercises. I appreciate you spending some time with that. Can you talk a little bit about the communication? You, the book goes over communicating with animals, and we don't have a lot of time to discuss in detail this, and we definitely want people to purchase the book. But is it your intention that we become intuitively aware of the communication of these animals, specifically birds? I want to talk about, because you talk about bird communication, and it's something that the thing that I find fascinating in your observations is that it's not just the sound they make; it's the body language. It's their surroundings that they're communicating to. There's so much to perceive that I just don't think anyone's ever discussed it in that way. I've heard of people talk about the intuition between humans and animals, but can you talk a little bit about the communication aspect that you have found and how it's revealed to you in your connection with animals?
Yeah, you bet. And birds are a good example, again, because they are everywhere. Manhattan, there are birds in Manhattan. Every city has birds. You don't have to go far to find birds. And they're all native wild birds. It's just beautiful to have this form of nature so close by that is so easily observable to people to learn nature speak, to learn the language of the animals, is to not listen. I suggest that people wear earplugs, believe it or not, to learn how birds communicate. Because the bird song we hear is a very small part of their communication, their communication repertoire. It's a very small part of their language. And because we are so sight and sound oriented, we want to tune into the sounds. And oftentimes it's easy with birds too, because especially in the woods, you can hear birds singing, but you can't see them so easily. Well, if we put in earplugs, the first thing that happens is that when one sense is shut down, that energy goes to the other senses. It's a survival mechanism, because we need our senses in order to connect with the outside world, in order to take care of ourselves. And you've probably heard of some of the amazing things that blind people can do. And that is because their one sight is shut down, and their sense of touch is so much more acute. Their sense of hearing is so much more acute. So we do the same thing. When you're going out to observe birds, wear earplugs, and you're not going to hear the birds' songs. However, they are communicating so much more than their songs by the way they move, by where they perch, not just the fact that they're perched in a tree, but where they're perched and what they're up to. Is this a male? Giving out a territorial boundary signal, and the signal is not audio. You know, we think, oh, it's the song. Well, that's a small part of it, because oftentimes other birds can't hear the song, but a cardinal can be seen from a long ways off, a lot further than the cardinal can be heard, and birds have an acute sense of sight. So the male cardinals for quite a distance can pick up on the other male cardinals, because they're bright red. They're designed to be seen, not heard. And this is true of so many birds. You notice how brightly colored the males are and how camouflage colored most of the females are. Well, it's for this reason. They are communicating so much. And I talk about this in the book to give people some head start on what to observe, what to read by observing birds. It's fascinating as to what they are telling us all the time, just by going through their normal rhythms, their normal patterns.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. I want to just also touch on your discussion on communicating or having impressions from trees. Now, we don't typically sense that trees have an intelligence, but it's like there is an intelligence that you describe, and you can get. Is it communication with trees, or is it more like a sense like, yes, I acknowledge your presence there, human, how are you today kind of thing? What is that kind of communication? That fascinates me.
Yeah, it's back to the organ within the organism again. Trees are sentient beings, not in the same way we are, for sure, but they have their own form of sentience. They have their own way of communicating. Do you know that tree roots touch each other's roots, and they are communicating with each other? There's some trees even exchange nutrients, and they are communicating with the animals around. I know a good example. The native elders have taught me that when I go out, let's say I want to pick raspberries, I want to go out and gather raspberries and bring them back and dry some or freeze some for the white season, for the winter time. Well, I'll go out and I won't just start picking right away. What they taught me to do was to give before I receive. And they use a sacred herbal mixture called kinnikinnick. And they will take a pinch of this kinnikinnick and hold it for a moment to, in essence, infuse it with their energy so that they're giving something of themselves. And they'll lay this down before the raspberries. And they will ask if it's okay to pick some raspberries. And the raspberry plant's not going to say, oh, yeah, you know, you can take about 25% of my berries, you know, because there's some, you know, it's yeah. Not like that. But the process of asking is opening me to listen, and I will become more observant. And also, when I give something, I create an opening within myself rather than just gimme, gimme, gimme. You know, it's there I'm saying that, oh, I'm the center of my universe and I want more. I want more of what I think I need. it's the other way around. I'm creating trust by giving first. Giving is receiving, is what the Native elders told me. And when I give, I create an opening because I'm creating some space within myself. And here's where the communication starts, because then I see the raspberries and I see how, oh, these raspberries are growing in the shade here. They're not quite as prolific as those raspberries over there. And I see that, these raspberries have been nibbled on. And I can tell that, oh, yeah, there must be a family of chipmunks here. They're nibbling on these raspberries. They climb up on the raspberry canes and eat here. You know, maybe I'll go over there where the raspberries are a little more lush. And I'm picking all this up. Without thinking about it, I'm describing it verbally to you, but I just picked this up at a glance right away because of my openness. And this is the communication that's going on. And we do the same thing verbally. I can tell you what my needs and wants are and what my fears are and these sorts of things. Well, the raspberry bush is doing exactly the same thing.
Wow. And would you say that's transferable to, say, an old oak tree? You're walking by an oak tree and you want to communicate. Is it something like you want to communicate, or is it more like you're walking by and you kind of hint, you get a hint of them communicating to you that you're in their presence? Or because I there's something about an ancient oak or an ancient redwood tree here in Northern California. There's trees that are thousands of years old, or a thousand years old. I would think there was some form of communication that could go on between a tree, and that's why when you mentioned that in your book, I thought that's kind of cool. You know, that's kind of really tapping in, being one with nature.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great example, Cliff. And I think one of the reasons for this reverence for ancient trees is that those ancient trees, oftentimes they're mostly dead. You know, they're decaying inside. They're actually more alive. There's more life and vibrancy in that tree than there is in a young living tree, because of the total organism approach. Again, this old tree has so much life there. There are hollows in this tree where squirrels have their nests and birds have their nests, and there are salamanders under the bark, and there are insects. And there are mushrooms growing out of the tree. There are fungi, you know, attacking the tree and breaking the tree down. And there's mistletoe growing, parasitizing the tree. There's this whole community in this ancient dead tree. It's not just the tree. You know, when we look at it from our rational perspectives, we slap a label on it. Oh, yeah. Ancient redwood tree, old redwood tree. No. that's the smallest part of the life energy there. There's all this other life in that tree, and that's where the sense of just almost instinctive reverence comes up. Oh, wow, look at this old tree. That's what it's all about. It's about this whole living, vibrant community.
Yeah, wow. Hey, the last question for you, and this has been a lot of fun for me, is based on your knowledge, your teachings from elders and your work in this wonderful book, Becoming Nature, where are we heading? Where is our culture going? Is it a good site? Is it a good future that you feel, or are we going to land in a bad place? What do you think?
Oh boy. Well, from Earth perspective, there is no good or bad. There just is. There have been many cataclysms. There have been giant asteroids that have crashed into our planet, and we've gone through extreme ice ages. And what we are affecting right now is one of those cataclysms. Probably we are very much consciously doing it. We are consciously doing it. We know what we're doing. Whether we take responsibility for it is another question, but we know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So what is going to happen is going to be nothing different than has happened in the past. It's just that human hands are involved this time where they weren't in the past, or probably weren't. We don't know. There's a lot of speculation about ancient civilizations. some of which have destroyed themselves. And that could very well be. So personally, I'm the eternal optimist. I know that life is going to go on, maybe not life as we know it, but there's going to be matter, there's going to be a universe of some sort, and are we going to be a part of it? Do we have any control in the matter? Is what we're doing part of a greater plan? Maybe it's intended that we do what we're doing. I have no idea. What I do know is what I touch and taste and feel and smell, and I want that to be here for myself and my children. That's just instinct, and that's why I want to take care of what's here. I want to be an earth keeper. I want to be a responsible child of the mother.
Wonderful. Well, this book, Becoming Nature, Learning the Language of Wild Animals and Plants, is fascinating. My guest today has been Tamarack Song, and his book is available. It's been out now for a few months, I believe, and you can get it on Amazon, or you can go to Inner Traditions, which is the publisher, Barron & Company, and get your copy there. Tamarack, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed our time together.
Well, Cliff, thank you for having me. It's been great sharing. And if you invite me back, I'd be glad to come and explore some more.
Love to do that. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed that. Tamarack Song is it's an amazing guy. The book Becoming Nature just came out, and it's filled with some really, really, really interesting ways to really connect with nature when you're out for a walk. No, it doesn't matter where you are. It's just a way to revitalize your body, mind, and your spirit. So I really urge you to get that book, Becoming Nature. And I found it quite interesting and educational. There's a lot of information in there that's quite good. Okay, now as I mentioned, next week is a special program with three authors: Mike Berra, Scott Walter, and Clifford Mahuti. And that will be our upcoming show, and I hope you enjoy it. Make sure to check at Facebook, and we will talk to you again.